For guys, size matters. But bigger is definitely not better for guys with overdeveloped breasts. The condition is called gynecomastia, and Dr. Frank Lista of the Plastic Surgery Clinic can help. Dr. Lista is a world-renowned plastic surgeon who has perfected the procedure that corrects gynecomastia with virtually no scarring. Visit theplasticsurgeryclinic.ca and size up your options for downsizing male breasts. Theplasticsurgeryclinic.ca.
Three things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company: politics, religion, and money. Better add sports, too. And since he's not always polite company, he'll maybe address all four. Jeff Blair and the Jeff Blair Show. Now. On Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
The NFL season gets going tonight. And Roger Goodell will be watching on TV. Or at least won't be in the stadium as the Steelers and Patriots get the season going. It's going to be great to see actual, honest-to-God, meaningful football played after everything that's gone on in the NFL this preseason and certainly this offseason as well. Most of it, of course, focusing on the New England Patriots and Bill Belichick. Charles Robinson is a senior NFL and investigative reporter for Yahoo Sports. You can follow him on Twitter at Charles Robinson, and he joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. So, Charles, when kickoff happens today, when Tom Brady takes the field for the first time and the first snap is made and the game gets going, is Deflategate, do your job, everything, is that all behind us once the games actually start?
Every time I make a prediction about whether it's finally behind us, something else happens. So I'll say this. I mean, look, the Brady... the whole issue with the appeal, you know, that's still got to go to the second court of appeals. So, and that's not really likely to happen until the off season, but that alone, you know, predicates this isn't behind us until that's finished. And, but in terms of the regular season, I think that a void will be filled, with the lack of things to talk about. You know, we've got this sort of scandal fatigue from the Patriots this off season, and, you know, now that football's back, I mean, that tends to fade away some of those other things and we get back to the games. But, you know, Deflategate's not over until it's out of the court system, and that's got a ways to go yet. The more recent stuff, the SI report, the ESPN report, I think filled in a lot of the gory details, particularly the ESPN report, filled in a lot of the gory details of Spygate and whatnot, but I don't know how much further any of that stuff's going to go. Even though I think in the middle of that report, this idea of stealing play sheets was probably the most serious allegation we've heard yet.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's that's the one when you read it, when you see that report, and you try to digest everything that's in there. I mean, that's the one that really stands out to me as being egregious. Right. But you know what? I got to tell you, with everything we've heard about the Patriots and Bill Belichick, I think a lot of people had the first response that I had to it, which maybe says something about us, something not very good. But my first response was, okay, I can see that. You know, yeah. That's no surprise. And, I'm at the point now where I think if you like Bill Belichick and you're Patriots fans, I mean, they can't do any wrong. And if you don't like them, you know, nobody's opinion is going to change on this. But I don't know if we've just had Patriots fatigue or Belichick fatigue, but I have a hard time getting worked up about it. And that kind of bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I mean, there is fatigue. And, you know, that phrase, scandal fatigue, is, I think it's legitimate. It's something that we've heard so many things, and it's just over and over. And after a while, you just kind of, like, gloss over. And even the Spygate details, they're ugly. I mean, it's when you hear the totality of it, you're like, man, okay. You know, it was probably as bad as we thought it could have been. But the truth is, too, and I tell fans this whenever they ask, how bad is that really? I sat in press boxes for a decade before, you know, we ever really even heard of Spygate, and sat next to advanced scouts with huge binoculars who sat there scribbling down signals and play formations on the field. And, you know, and my point was, this isn't new, you know, it's legal, you know, what these advanced scouts are doing, sitting next to me, behind me in the press box. I mean, they spend, you know, an untold amount of time trying to marry signals to plays and all this stuff. And the Patriots just found a way to do it what they felt like was more accurately. And see, that to me is sort of the crux of all this. All the things that come up about the Patriots that we don't like, mm-hmm. or other people don't like, you can always find people in the NFL to go, eh, that happens. You know, right. You can find people who shrug and say these things happen. But you know, to go back to the play sheet, that was like the one thing in all of this, the deflation of footballs, taping of signals, you know, these 50 million things, the headsets, all the stuff. That's like the one thing where you kind of get people in the NFL who are like, that's a little, you know, that's a little far, that's a little out there. But everything else, they kind of shrug and go, you hear about it, you think it happens, maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. It doesn't seem to really blow people away until you kind of get to this idea of maybe absolute out and out theft of game plan. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Charles, who's the best team in the AFC East right now?
Wow, that is the question. I frankly want to see Tyrod Taylor. You know, I want to see Tyrod Taylor play before I crown that division. Every year, you know, we've gone through years where we're like, the question about, you know, well, who is it? And it always ends up being the Patriots. Mm-hmm. I think this is the year that legitimately the Bills defense, if healthy, is sick. And it could be that kind of defense that I think could propel them to the top of that division. I think Miami, if Ryan Tannehill takes that step forward, if Sue solidifies the defensive front the way we think he's capable, if Lamar Miller could take a step forward at running back, that's a team that arguably I think could be at the top of the division. And the one thing about the Patriots scandal that's glossed over a lot, they lost a ton on defense. You know, offensively, Julian Edelman has to be healthy for that team to be where it needs to be. And Brandon LaFell's on PUP for 6 weeks. He doesn't get back until October 25th. So offensively, there's a little bit that scares you. And then the losses defensively for the Patriots. But I will say that I believe the Bills and the Miami Dolphins are more equipped this year to take over that division than any years past.
As we get ready for the start of the season, is there a surprise team out there, a team that's got your eye as a club that maybe a lot of people are underselling? I mean, a lot of people seem to be getting on the Chargers bandwagon this year, but is there a team that you see as maybe better poised than people think it is?
In terms of, you know, I'll say this about Houston. You know, the quarterback situation is a little bit of a mess there. You know, I don't know that they even have their quarterback that they'll have starting next season. But I will say this about the defense. It is really good. It's a really good defense, and it's I think if they get something out of Jadeveon Clowney this year, if they get even 80%, 90% of what they hope to get out of him, they're going to rack up a lot of sacks, and teams are going to have a really, really hard time dealing with Vince Wilfork on the defensive line, you know, J.J. Watt and Clowney, because they're going to move Watt all over the field. They're going to give him some freedom a la Lawrence Taylor, I think an even more increased freedom a la Lawrence Taylor to roam in that defense. And, you know, I think Clowney off the edge could end up being a double-digit sack guy if he can stay healthy. And their cornerbacks are very, very good. Their safeties are a little scary, but they're. I think that defense could potentially, by the end of the season, be the best defense in the NFL. Now, offensively, they're going to be no good until Arian Foster gets back. They got to be able to run the football. But within that division, you know, Jacksonville is going to be a little bit better than we think. Tennessee's probably going to be pretty bad. And maybe we're overinflating Indianapolis at this stage as being this automatic AFC Super Bowl team. I think Houston could end up being a double-digit win team, and I don't think a lot of people expect that right now.
In conversation with Charles Robinson of Yahoo Sports, getting back to Tom Brady for a minute, what do you expect to see from him in this game? All the stuff that's gone on, has it, in your mind, in any way interfered with what he needs to do to get ready for the season? Or do you expect to see Tom Brady just, be Tom Brady?
I think it interferes. It's a toll. I mean, he missed some preseason practices, which mm-hmm. is unusual. Just the 10 court hearings. I think that it's something that anytime you go through this kind of thing, if you're a player, and I've seen players go through particularly the court system in the off season, and they'll tell you it becomes that thing that's always on your mind every morning you wake up. I definitely think that takes a toll, and I don't like this idea that, well, the last time the Patriots, really had to go through a scandalous off season, the next year they came out and they were an offensive juggernaut. You know what? You had Randy Moss. You don't have Randy Moss on this team, okay? You had Dante Stallworth, who people forget was an amazing deep threat as a number two on that team. You had other elements on that team that just don't exist now. And I think that people forget that and they get ahead of themselves thinking, well, Tom Brady's going to come out of this just setting the world on fire. I mean, again, we don't even know really how healthy Julian Edelman is going into this first game. He's got to rely on a Danny Amendola. He's got to rely on an Aaron Dobson who could have been off the team a year ago. They almost cut him.
Mm-hmm.
So offensively, the pieces around him are not going to, I don't think, going to be a conduit for this massive 50-touchdown kind of season out of Tom Brady. But, I will say this as well. You talk to any of the guys in that locker room, and they will tell you he is as focused as he's ever been. All he wants to do is get back to playing football. All he wants to do is be in the facility working on, being better this year. And I guess in and of itself, that's pretty intriguing, but I have a hard time believing that that's not Tom Brady every year.
One of the things that happened with all the emphasis on Deflategate and the ESPN reports and things of that nature is Jameis Winston was kind of allowed to go ahead and just kind of have a regular training camp. What do you expect from him this year? I mean, he was a guy who was a lightning rod going into the draft. What are you expecting from him?
Here's the thing about Jameis. The offensive line, he's going to get hit a lot, that's the one thing I noticed. And I usually like to take my preseasons, and I probably watch quarterbacks more than anything else, because you can get a little bit of an accurate read in terms of what's going to happen with some of these guys. Can they get into a rhythm? I think the one thing we saw with him and that staff is already recognizing, and this is not uncommon with rookie quarterbacks, is that he is hanging on to that ball a little bit too long. And it's causing him to get hit behind that offensive line. And I think that's going to be pretty consistent. It's just, what will he do after taking some of this punishment? Is he going to throw the football away, or is he going to make some of the mistakes he made in college and throw off his back foot, throw into coverage, try and rely on his arm too much? He does have pieces around him, particularly in the wide receiving core, even a tight end. And people will tell you, look, a rookie quarterback, the tight end becomes his best friend pretty early in the season. Austin Seferian Jenkins there is a pretty good, talented tight end for him. But he's going to get hit, and unless they can run the football, they're not going to be able to take pressure off him. And again, I want to see, people are excited about Doug Martin again. Let me see you do it in the preseason. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of hearing about Doug Martin and not seeing it in the preseason. So Doug Martin or Charles Sims has to come out of the gate being, very strong, 5-yard carry, 4.5-yard carry guy to really protect Jameis. And otherwise, you're going to see Jameis, particularly in the first 8 games of the season, take a lot of hits.
Which of the rookies do you think is the guy who is going to have the best season, the guy we're going to be talking about at the end of the season?
Amari Cooper's just looked amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't like to pick rookie wide receivers, and even in light of last season, I mean, Odell Beckham Jr. to me was such an aberration. Jarvis Landry, I mean, there were so many good wide receivers, and that rarely happens, but now you get kids that are coming out of college who have played wide receiver 12 months a year with 7-on-7 football now.
Mm-hmm.
You get wide receivers who are coming out of college who have played 12 months a year at their position for, most of their life now. So I think guys are coming out a lot more refined. And even though I don't want to pick a wide receiver at this spot, seeing Amari Cooper, first off, he was uncoverable in practice. no matter who the Raiders put on him. And then to see him in the preseason games, I mean, I think one of the most popular vines that I put up this offseason was when they played the Cardinals and he absolutely torched Patrick Peterson. Now, Patrick Peterson might be a little bit overrated, but he's one of the better young quarterbacks in the league, and he could not stick with Amari Cooper. Plus, Derek Carr loves Amari Cooper. I mean, you're going to probably see an average of 10 targets a game if as long as Amari Cooper and Derek Carr both stay healthy. He's immediately bonded with him and started to count on him as a true number one. So he's going to get a ton of opportunities. And I think, you know, if people spend a little time watching Amari Cooper, you're going to see a guy that you're going to say, wow, that does not look like a rookie. It looks like a 3-4 year vet. He's that good.
And I'll tell you, you know, we're so used to just kind of overlooking the Raiders. If somehow that relationship, and, you know, you're right, there's two pretty young guys, if that can develop, it really gives the Raiders something to build around. To have those two, to have Derek Carr and Cooper on the same page, it really does give them something to build around offensively that might be sustainable.
Yeah, and that's what they wanted. You know, they got another young kid in the backfield, Latavius Murray, that they feel really good about. Big, tall kid, a running back, real strider when he gets into the open field. But, you know, whenever you draft a quarterback that high, and if you go through a rookie season and you're like, wow, this is our guy, the first thing you do as a coaching staff, if you don't think there's already a player in the staff, is find him a number one to pair with and let those two grow up together.
Right.
And that was part of why they drafted Amari Cooper. And I can tell you on draft day, they were praying that Amari would fall to them at four, because as draft day approached and Jacksonville was sitting there at number three, I think a lot of staffs all of a sudden said, hey, this kid out of Alabama is probably the best player in the draft, but he's a wide receiver. You can't take him over a Mariota. You can't take him over a Winston. And from what I understood, there was a very big debate within the Jacksonville Jaguars franchise between taking the outside linebacker Dante Fowler or Amari Cooper. And, you know, ultimately defense won out, and the Raiders could, I mean, they were doing handstands when that happened on draft day. So, you know, they got exactly what they wanted. And it's a very smart, extremely talented kid who's very serious about his craft, and it's worked wonders for Derek Carr. And I think they kind of feel like, hey, this might be sort of our, I don't want to say Derek Carr's Peyton Manning, but in terms of just sheer relationship, our Peyton Manning, Marvin Harrison duo that can take us the next 10 years.
Charles, we appreciate you doing this this morning. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Charles Robinson, a senior NFL and investigative reporter for Yahoo Sports. You can follow him on Twitter at Charles Robinson. We're going to turn now to one of our favorites, Mark Malone, NFL analyst for Westwood One. He's also the host of Under Center with Mark Malone, which you can hear Monday to Friday, 3 to 7 on NBC Sports Radio. You can follow him on Twitter at Under Center NBC. Mark, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure, Jeff. How's your offseason been?
Offseason's been great. How is yours?
Short, but
short and complicated, I guess, in a lot of ways. You know, Mark, look, you've been a quarterback. You've gone through training camp. Tom Brady takes the field tonight. How normal a preseason has he been able to have, given everything that's gone on with Deflategate?
Well, listen, the distractions are the distractions, and each player, each team deal with a different set of distractions every year. There's always something to deal with. Players in the National Football League are creatures of habit. They like to have structure. They like to be able to know exactly what they're doing, and to a certain extent, that's been a bit of a distraction for Tom. But in terms of, you know, what he's been able to do on the field in preparation for the regular season, I don't know that that's changed much, to be honest with you. I think Bill Belichick addressed it earlier in one of his press conferences, you know, when he was asked what it was like to have Tom Brady back after Judge Berman overturned the 4-game suspension. He goes, he hasn't left. He's been here. He's been involved in the meetings. He's been involved in the on-the-field stuff. Tom's a pro in his 16th year in the National Football League. And I don't suspect that this is going to be much of a big deal for him. Some of the changes on the roster and how that offense functions, given the people that surround him, might be, I think, something more to pay a closer attention to than some of the off-the-field stuff, to be honest with you.
Who's the best team in the AFC East right now?
Oof. Well, John Madden used to always say, listen, until somebody beats the champion, they're the champion. So I think you have to lean toward New England. I've kind of been beating the drum a little bit for Miami. I like what Miami's done. They've gone out and gotten Ndamukong Suh, which I think is going to make their defense a heck of a lot better. They suffered some injuries in the preseason, the back half of that defense, which is a bit of a concern. But I like the weapons surrounded Ryan Tannehill with, who continues to get a little bit better every year. The deal they made with New Orleans to bring Kenny Stills over, who I've liked since he got into the league, I think will help them. You've got a lot of young, fast wide receivers. I think that's a football team that's on the rise. And if New England slips a little bit, I know a lot of people are thinking Buffalo might have a run at this thing, but I really kind of think Miami's the dark horse in that division.
Who do you think are the favorites right now?
Well, listen, I think everybody likes Green Bay. The loss of Jordy Nelson is a hard one to swallow. The fact that they've signed James Jones, who was there before and had a lot of success in that offense, I think certainly helps them a little bit. The biggest question marks really have been on the offensive line, to be honest with you, on the defensive side of the football. But I like Green Bay, who opened up in Chicago, and they've won their last five straight against the Bears in Chicago. Seattle, a good football team, a lot of distractions. They've rebuilt that offensive line, major question mark. But what does Jimmy Graham give them in the red zone? And how does that defense function without Cam Chancellor? How long does he hold out, I think, is a big question mark. And I think you've got to look at the Colts, to be honest with you. They continue to get better and better every year. The additions of Frank Gore, I think, will help that football team immensely. They have question marks on the offensive line and certainly on the defensive side of the football as well. But, Andrew Luck, I think, is the new face of the National Football League. He continues to get better. Big, strong kid who makes good decisions with a strong arm. And I think they're on the rise. So you got to keep your eye on the Colts, I think.
What are you expecting from the Bills this year? Again, obviously a lot of focus on Tyrod Taylor. And by the way, the Bills just announced, or I should say Adam Schefter's just reporting, the Bills have signed Marcel Darius to a six-year, $108 million extension. So that's a bit of business done. But what are you expecting from Tyrod Taylor?
Well, Tyrod Taylor is an interesting case study. I mean, he's a guy that kept Baltimore and really didn't get much of a chance to play football. I was impressed with him in the preseason, not only in his ability to move around and extend plays, which I think appeals to Rex Ryan, but I thought he threw the ball with some pretty good accuracy and made some pretty good decisions in the preseason. My problem with Buffalo is this, and it's been my problem with every Rex Ryan coach football team. They are defense-centric. Okay, that's fine. But the game itself continues to evolve and rules change to make it an offensive football game. And when you have, to a certain extent, an untested and therefore an unreliable quarterback in Tyrod Taylor, you're not really sure what you have offensively. Rex Ryan's never been able to identify in his head coaching career or draft or cultivate, if you will, good offensive talent. And mm-hmm. I think that's an issue for the Buffalo Bills. You've got to be able to score points to win in this league and to win a championship. And that right now.
Conversation with Mark Malone and the Jeff Blair Show. Interesting item on NFL.com that caught my attention. I'd read this article early in the year about Seattle, the Seahawks assistant coach Tom Cable, kind of questioning why it seems as if a lot of the offensive players coming into the NFL from college ranks have at least in his mind, are having a more difficult time adapting to pro style of offense. And his argument in that of Les Snead, the Rams GM, is, look, maybe instead of waiting for some of these young quarterbacks to adapt to the NFL, and I think in a lot of ways a lot of this focuses on RG3, we have to do a better job of adapting to them. And, I mean, both of these gentlemen, Mark, seem to think that it's not that there's a quarterback crisis coming, but it's taking a longer time to develop young quarterbacks because they've got to learn the terminology. They've got to learn how to run a huddle. In a pro-style offense. Is that an issue for the NFL, do you think, a growing issue?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. And there's not only the verbiage in order to communicate, motions, formations, play calls, audibles at the line of scrimmage, all those kinds of things, to learn the language, as you said, in the National Football League. But the NCAA has really handcuffed college programs and coaches around the country because they only have a short period of time to work with these kids, and that's monitored by the NCAA. So coaches over the years have taken a look at that and said, okay, listen, we don't have time to really develop and teach these kids how to play a quarterback in the pocket, teach them the nuances of the position. So what I'm going to do is take the best athlete I have on my football team and put him at the quarterback position. And then I'm going to spread that defense out. We're going to run the zone read. We're going to do some things. Not that the kid can't throw, but he operates in an entirely different offensive system. And then when you get to the National Football League, especially with slotted draft choices now, you don't have the big bonus babies. I think Sam Bradford is the last of those. I don't know that NFL franchises have patience anymore for quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. You throw a guy in there, and if he doesn't develop in, you know, 2 years, 3 years, let's move on to the next guy. I mean, this guy's not going to kill us from a cap standpoint. We're not into him for $50, $70, $80 million. Let's go ahead and draft the next kid. So I think there's been a lack of patience as well. The question is now, does the spread offense, as we see it in college football, start to emerge in the National Football League? We've seen some of it, not only with RG3 in his rookie season, but certainly Russell Wilson does a little bit of it in Seattle. But the other thing that happens is that guy has traditionally been your franchise player, the face of the franchise. Are you willing at the NFL level to expose him to the kinds of hits that he's going to have to take in a spread offense and running the zone read and so forth? And that's the other thing. I mean, listen, quarterbacks in the National Football League don't have a very long shelf life if they expose themselves to those kinds of hits. So that's something that the NFL has to rectify as well in their own minds about how they're going to deal with quarterbacks moving forward.
Mark, it was great to talk to us today. Always fascinating. Thank you.
Jeff, my pleasure, man. Have a good football season.
You too. That is Mark Malone, NFL analyst for Westwood One. He is also host of Under Center with Mark Malone, which you can hear Monday to Friday on Sports Radio. For my money, one of the best analysts in the NFL. The hometown hockey schedule has been released. It will start October 10th to 11th in Kitchener. It will wind up in my hometown or near my hometown April 2nd to 3rd in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Ron McLean is host of Rogers Hometown Hockey, and Ron McLean will join us in studio when the Jeff Blair Show continues on the home of the Blue Jays, Toronto Sports Radio, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, we're back just ahead of Baseball Central. Ben Nicholson-Smith will join me, and then, of course, Kevin Barker for 2 hours of baseball talk. Rogers Hometown Hockey is back for another season, and the schedule dates have been announced starting October 11th in Kitchener and winding up in Winnipeg on April 3rd. So, yes, they have saved the best for the last.
Well,
Ron McLean is the host.
Yeah. Outside of Selkirk. What's your actual hometown? Isn't it a smaller?
It's Morden, which is Selkirk with worse shopping.
Oh, Morden,
as we refer to it.
That takes me back to Winkler when we did Hockey Day in Canada there 1 year. And it was a dry town, Winkler, like Steinbach.
Yeah.
And the guys, the firefighters at Morden, brought over a whole slew of little liquor bottles for Don Cherry. We don't drink that. We drink beer, but it was kind of them to think of us.
Yeah, it's Winkler and Morden are arch rivals, and we always used to kind of think we had one up on Winkler because, A, we weren't a dry town, and, B, even better, we had a movie theater.
Oh, well.
And Winkler, I mean, there was no way they were getting – now, of
the
course.
The staunchest, although fascinating for anyone who doesn't know the history of Winkler, all the Mennonites who were pacifists had to leave Canada and ended up in Mexico, and so they returned with this incredible culinary gift of Mexican cuisine combined with anything else.
Oh, yeah.
But when you went to the rink in Winkler, you got tacos in a bag rather than a hot dog and popcorn. They had some amazing things. And I was telling Jeff that and here's a good hometown hockey story because, as you said, we're going to finish up in Winnipeg on April the 3rd. It's 24 Sundays, obviously visiting all these communities, celebrating grassroots hockey stories and with NHL games involved on Sportsnet this year, and that's the message. I think I've got through the message. Mm. But we go to Winnipeg on the 3rd of April. It'll be a special finale. I met Miriam Taves, the author, who hails from really Steinbach, Manitoba, but she is kind of a Winnipeg girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote All My Puny Sorrows and a selection of other fantastic books. Swing Low, it's the story of her dad who succumbed to mental illness resulting in suicide. But her dad, when he was young, delivered eggs all over Winnipeg, and one day he saw a home in Winnipeg that he thought he'd love to build for his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought his wife from Steinbach up to Winnipeg to look at this house on his egg delivery day. And she loved the house, but she said, I wonder what it's like inside. And she brazenly went up to the front door and knocked on the door, and the guy welcomed her into her home and showed her around, and that guy happened to be Bill Mozienko, one of the players of the time.
Fastest three goals,
got
right?
21-second hat trick, a legend, and that's so hockey. You know, here's a guy just that kind of shows you the humility that I think the show shows.
Yeah, it's, it was so much fun last year. And, you know, someone who grew up in a small town and moved across the country. I mean, I've lived in Calgary, I've lived in Winnipeg, Ottawa, here, Montreal. And because I started out in newspapers, I had a chance to go to a lot of small communities covering junior hockey originally and all that. And I think because we tend to be sort of urban focused, Ron, sometimes we forget just how good the stories are in smaller towns.
Well, a highlight for me was meeting the AAA midget coaches in all those towns. Like Red Deer, Alberta, my hometown, the coach was Dave Manning, a legend. And he begat a coach named Doug Quinn, who won two championship midget titles in 2012 and 2013 with the Red Deer Optimist Chiefs. But in the case of Thompson, Manitoba, the guy's name is Doug Corman. In the case of Montreal, the West Island of Montreal, Dollar Desormeaux, I met John Goyens, whose father was Chris Goyens, who wrote the Jean Beliveau book, and it was a great broadcast journalism guy and writer. Anyway, John Goyens, coaching the Lac St. Louis Lions, he explained to me that P.J. Stock's dad was the guy who taught everybody on the West Island how to skate. Now, P.J., in 6 to 10 years working together, never mentioned that. But John Goyens taught me about Dean and P.J.'s dad, and that's the stuff, you know, that it's just so, as you say, community.
How physically demanding is this for you? Because this is a lot of travel. I mean, you're starting October 11th. You finish April 3rd. It's a big production. I mean, people who haven't seen it, the truck, the whole thing, there's a lot of travel. You're always Ron McLean.
Yeah,
wherever
you're meet
you go,
and greet.
You're Ron McLean. You're meet and greet all the time.
But the energy of that, I think, Jeff, makes it possible. And, you know, Tara Sloan is my co-host, and she'll be there for every 24 Sundays this year. And Jennifer Bottrell, the great Olympic hockey champion, she'll be there for a lot of them. You know, they obviously handle a lot of the heavy lifting, too. What I found really challenging, and you mentioned to me off air just before we went on, you know, with all that's gone on in baseball, I mean, you look at a day like today, the NFL, it's medicals for all the training camps for the NHL. The World Cup just got announced, and you've got the Jays playing the Yankees tonight. That was what I found challenging, is getting up to speed on each new community, trying, you know, I would always go out for drinks after the show on the Sunday night, kind of drag myself home on Monday and try to get ready. And then, because we work Saturday night, Sunday night on the air, and I play hockey two nights a week, I was starting to lose touch with watching the NHL, which is really, you know, I don't know how you do it, you know, covering such a wide variety of subjects and writing on top of it. It's, you know, you can stretch yourself only so far. So that part was challenging, but it was just so rewarding, and I don't mean that just to be a shill. I really felt what, you know, you're a writer. So the stories, the features that Mark LeBlanc and Stephen Brunt and our team put together, that part of it, the storytelling, you know, this was a show that could actually do that well. And then the just the simplicity of, you know, being for everybody a connection to the NHL, you know, that they could kind of touch and feel and see is just as normal and ordinary as them.
And nice. And you made the point about P.J. Stock's father. There are so many of these nuggets that, you know, I think a lot of times people, athletes in particular, they've had interesting stuff happen to them. They've had important people in their lives. But once you get into the NHL or once you become a pro, there's almost a sense that it's not that it wasn't that important, but it tends to get usurped by other things. I mean, you know, Kevin Barker, who co-hosts Baseball Central with me, he's got some great stories, but a lot of times he goes, yeah, but you know, I mean, they were kind of there in the minors. I go, yeah, but Kevin, the people who are listening, I've never played minor league baseball would be a dream to me. The stuff that sometimes guys don't find that interesting, those little nuggets are really what the fans really want to hear, because that kind of makes it, brings it down to their level almost.
Our first show will be in Kitchener, and it's a special Thanksgiving edition. Ed Robertson and the Bare Naked Ladies, Tyler Stewart, thinks he's the best hockey player. So, you know, they'll be with us on the show. But Don Cameron was the 50-year voice of the Rangers, and he's retired. So Mike Farwell and Mike Torkia was the goaltender for the Kitchener Rangers. He's the color analyst this year for Rangers OHL hockey. He has been for a while, but Torkia, I went to the Cops Coliseum. Again, this is just to show you how ingrained in us it is. Torkia plays for Kitchener in game one of that Memorial Cup that year in the round robin, 1990, Cops Coliseum, now First Ontario Place. And he wins in overtime against Corey Hirsch. And so there's a connection. Corey Hirsch is with us on Sportsnet, you know, now all the time. And he ends up, Mike Torkia, taking the Rangers all the way to the Memorial Cup final. They lose to Eric Lindros and the Oshawa Generals in double overtime, I think. It might have just been overtime. But while I'm at that game, up at the top tier of the lower bowl, there's a woman sitting next to me who I don't know, who's making notes about the game. And I said, boy, you're a dedicated fan. You're making a lot of notes there. What's it about? And she said, well, I like to make notes for my my son, who's in the National Hockey League. I said, oh, really? Who's that? She said, my son is Pat Quinn. And oh, so, you know, there I'll be in Kitchener with Mike Torkia, who played all those years ago. Stephen Wacom was the referee. The next week we'll be in North Bay, which is his hometown. And so it goes.
They just announced the World Cup of Hockey yesterday. And or it's been announced, but the more details came out yesterday. And, I mean, I'm one of these people. I love international hockey. And I love the concept of the team North, the young stars and the team Europe. I mean, I love some of the debates. You know, the players are being asked, what anthem would you play? What flag would you have for the team North American stars? What's your take on the World Cup? Because you, is it, I don't want to say as a brand, but do you think it'll resonate in some of these smaller, towns?
Well, our heroes resonate, you know, that's and I listened to you yesterday, Jeff, on that. And I think you were pretty you're good with it, right? You're sort of
I love the idea, as you said,
you know, you can't have Slovenia or so you. But I my only chagrin about the 23 concept is I do want to see Connor McDavid lace it up with someone at the tail end of their career. I think, you know, in the whole discussion about the Olympics as well, where, if anything, the Olympics has gotten a little off track is the grandeur of the host city has to be worth so much. And our joy of the Olympics has kind of come down to the lust or greed for gold. I never want to see that. I love what I love about Olympism is the great meets the small. The fact that, you know, as an example, we might have a Syrian athlete competing in Rio de Janeiro, and in view of what's been going on, that would be magic. That would be one reminder of what sports and Olympics and, but let's just say sports, ultimately kind of points toward, and that is the objective of trying to cope with humanity, of being our part in this whole mix. And sports does that so beautifully, and the great should meet the small. So Gretzky skates with Gordie Howe, perfect. And I regret that that won't happen, but on the whole, I mean, the hockey will be. I do worry, too, a little bit about, you know, will the old guys get frustrated and take a run at McDavid? Not necessarily McDavid. There always seems to be a little honor. But still, you know, they always say, Jeff, that Messier not hitting Brian Leetch because they had just won the cup together in 94 was kind of a turning point of the 96 World Cup. So it'll be great. We are hockey fans. It will be fantastic. But I wish that McDavid was lacing them up with, I don't know who the elder, I guess Taves. He's not even an elder statesman, but there would be a player who's, you know, due to bow out, and I'd love to see them play together for Canada versus have them on separate teams.
In conversation with Ron McLean, who will be host of Rogers Hometown Hockey again this season, starting October 11th in Kitchener, Ontario. The game is the Montreal Canadiens, the Ottawa Senators. It wraps up April 3rd in Winnipeg. The Chicago Blackhawks and the Vancouver Canucks will be the game. All right, because this is a Toronto radio station, I've got to ask you, big off season in Toronto, Mike Babcock's here, Lou Lamoriello's here. Culture change is kind of the catchphrase. How do you think this is all going to work out?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt. Like, I'm not shedding any new light here, but it would sure be good to finish last if you could win the lottery and then get Austin Matthews. That would be a step in a great direction. I think with those two that you mentioned, accountability is the word that comes to mind. I could give you a Lou Lamoriello story. When Brent Sutter was coaching the Devils, they played in Edmonton, and he took the team curling. And he wanted to have them just wear their tracksuits on the airplane over to Minneapolis, where they were headed to St. Paul to play next. And he phoned Lou. He said, Lou, I know we have a hard and fast rule that you got to be shirts and ties and jackets on planes. Would you mind if the guys wore track suits? It's a charter aircraft, and it would be easier when they leave Royal Glenora to just... He said, no, Brent, you know the rule. And when they landed at Minnesota, Lou was on the tarmac. He'd flown from New Jersey just to make sure. That's accountability. And that's what they're going to be dealing with in Toronto. And even Kessel, you know, when Brian Burke took the helm and made the trade for Kessel, who, let's face it, is a great goal scorer and might have been a good acquisition. He phoned the agent, and this is Lamoriello. Lamoriello always wants everybody to wear number 30 or lower. He doesn't want anybody to wear something that somehow singles them out and makes them above the group. And Brian Burke phoned Kessel's agent and said, listen, I'd really like to create a new culture here. Is there any way I could get Phil to ditch the 81 and kind of join the lower tier? And the agent says, no, Phil's worn 81 all his life. And it was almost like from that moment it was starting to break down for Brian in his attempt to change that culture. It won't happen with Lamoriello, and it wouldn't happen with Babcock either. That's the only, you know, how the two wolves coexist might be interesting in the long run. But Mike's, you know, he's so committed to that kind of thing. I think he'll lap it up.
One of the things too that I'm going to be fascinated in is both Mike and to a certain degree Lou have made a point about having their players' backs, and I know Mike has talked about we are going to come up with a way of alleviating the day-to-day pressures of dealing with the media from Dion. And it reminded me in some ways of what Joe Torre used to do with the Yankees all the time. And Joe Torre, towards the end of his career, just one day told the New York writers, you know, the reason I tried to be so good with you guys is I figured if I gave you a good entertaining 45 minutes, that was a good entertaining 45 minutes, you weren't going to be in the clubhouse talking to Derek or people like that. And I get the sense that one of the things this group will do is manage that a little better without being draconian, you know, without dropping the cone of silence and everything, but just sort of structuring or attempting to structure the day-to-day access the media has.
Well, Mike's first interview here on The Fan after he accepted the job, he explained, I want to make it in a safe environment.
Safe haven, I think was the word he used. Yeah.
And that's you know, when Don Cherry coached Boston, that was his sort of philosophy was, he certainly coached about love, not hate. He wanted the players to have no excuse.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they have an excuse is all those distractions that public relations divisions, sales divisions, et cetera, can impose. So Mike understands that in his two Olympic experiences, without a doubt, that's the biggest thing that they worked on is how to create because all professional athletes, the hardest part of their job is to not think about the game.
Sure.
That's where they wear out their, you know, energy dissipates in the afternoon when they're stressing. So they need diversion. They need escape. And family can be that. There's all kinds of different ways that you can create it and make the environment safe for them. But Babcock did a masterful job in addition to all the Hockey Canada gang that was involved. But he really worked at it in Vancouver. They could go out and be safe within their language, within their culture, and within their family. That wasn't going to be the case at Sochi, Russia. So he worked very hard to sort of replicate an environment that would make the guys feel like they could escape this pressure cooker that they're in. He's good at that. He's a teacher. And, you know, his expertise is, and he's got a little light, you know, there's a new book I have coming out in October called Hockey Towns, which is sort of like when Peter Zosky had Morningside and he had the Morningside Papers, which was a reflection of some of the great interviews or ideas that came up on his show. Hockey Towns will be that. Like, as an example, Brant Myers is a chapter, just signed on with the LA Kings as their sort of counselor. Babcock's the first story chapter. And it's, you know, when he coached the Lethbridge Pronghorns and they won the CIS title, they had a crucial game right at the beginning of the playoffs, do or die against the Calgary Dinosaurs, who were a great powerhouse. And they were going into overtime, and Mike went into the dressing room to speak to the team before they hit the ice. And just as he went to talk, the trainer's telephone in a little cubicle off the dressing room rang. So the trainer sheepishly runs in, picks up the receiver of an old landline, slams it down to stop it from ringing, comes back in the room, and Mike Babcock hollers at him, "Who's calling you now, for heaven's sakes?" And he probably words a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And the trainer said, "Oh, it was God, Mike. He wants us to win tonight." And the guys laughed at that. And from that moment forward in the playoffs, and they went all the way, he would always send his assistant coach, Trevor Keeper, whenever he had an important talk, he would send Trevor Keeper, the assistant coach, with 25 cents to a payphone in the arena to dial a call, you know, the trainer's room, and that was it. Oh, there's the big fella right now. He wants us to win tonight. And that little levity kind of carried them all the way to the title.
Ron, it was great of you to do this today. Thanks so much. Lots of great stories, and I'm sure there'll be more of them. The 2015-2016 Rogers Hometown Hockey broadcast schedule's out. You can get it on the website. Starts October 11th in Kitchener, winds up April 3rd in Winnipeg. Ron, thanks again for doing this.
And thanks for the support, Jeff. Great.
Thank you. Ron McLean joining us when we come back. Ben Nicholson-Smith joins me. Baseball Central's just around the corner.